Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and this evening we are talking about our shared Ireland and the future Ireland that we think is just to be. It appears to be. It's if I can again, I'm going to be killed because all I ever do is steal Aaron Dahi Roy quotes. But there's one where she says, "If you're quiet, you can hear her breathing. She's on the way. The future does seem to be on the way, Martin."
I think so, Tony. I think there's a kind of an inevitability to it now. I think we're just seeing the last throes of the old system.
Look, talking about the last throes of the old system, this is not a conversation that you want to be having, but we are delighted to be rejoined on the podcast by human rights equality and a professor in Queen's University Belfast, Colin Harvey. Professor Colin Harvey, good to talk to you again.
It's great to talk to you again. Delighted to be on the podcast again. Thank you very much for the invitation to return.
Yeah. No, the last time we had a brilliant conversation.
Absolutely.
And you focused predominantly on the positives, Colin. That's fair to say. You really did focus on all of the good things that were happening. But unfortunately, the reason that we're talking about this is not necessarily because of a positive thing. We're talking about what I'm going to term as political interference into your own ability to do the work that you've been doing in terms of the shared island and in terms of the panel for human rights. And it's been reported by several sources that the DUP have stepped in to block your appointment to one of these said panels.
Yeah, and some senses, I'm just like you, I'm responding to speculation in a sense that my name is now out there publicly, that it seems to be that it appears to be the case there's political blockage over my appointment to an expert panel on the Bill of Rights. In some senses, that's, you know, an odd thing to say is it's not that surprising. Over the last number of years since I've been involved with Ireland's future and some of the constitutional conversations around the future of the island, there's been a lot of positivity and a lot of people focused on the opportunities, but there's been a bit of a backlash as well, to be candid. So, you know, there are obviously people who are not comfortable with the fact that I've been involved in that conversation. So it's disappointing to see and a bit saddening, really, that somebody might object to my presence on an expert panel. You know, I'm a professor of human rights law. I've been working in this area all my academic career. I actually served on the Human Rights Commission here in the North for two terms. So I would have really welcomed the opportunity to assist the committee and the assembly, but it appears that's not to be.
And just on, if we can just rewind the tape back a little bit and actually talk about the purpose of this panel, first of all, the expert panel, and then a little bit about like the fact that you're a professor of human rights in Queen's, someone who seems eminently qualified to do the job, highly regarded on. I'm going to use that awful Americanized phrase across the political spectrum. It does seem to me to be like in keeping with some of the treatment that you've had since you started engaging with the Shared Future and the Ireland's Future campaign.
There is an element of consistency to it, but I would broaden it out a bit, you know, Tony Martin, in terms of the conversation, because ultimately the Bill of Rights that we're talking about was a promise really from the Good Friday Agreement. And one of the most frustrating things of recent years has been the extent to which some of those equality and human rights promises have been blocked. So I think really the tragedy in this is that we don't have a Bill of Rights. You know, this has been a 20-year process. It was launched in 2000. Commission submitted advice in 2008, but we don't have a Bill of Rights. This society desperately needs a Bill of Rights, you know, and we don't have it. And I think there's an element of just growing frustration in recent years around our political system seems to be incapable of delivering the sort of society that actually many people here want. We did polling earlier in the year ourselves, Ulster University and the Human Rights Consortium, a local NGO, just to ask people what they would like to see in this thing. And, you know, the amount of cross-community support in the North for basic socioeconomic rights around housing and healthcare is massive. You know, people want this stuff. And so it's really frustrating. So really, yeah, there's a personal dimension. You know yourself, people often say, don't take these things personally, right? Sometimes it's very hard not to take them personally when they are personal, you know, but there's a bigger ticket issue here. And the bigger issue is, you know, there's an impediment to the sort of society that people want in the North, you know, and that's deeply frustrating, not just for me, but for many, many people here.
Are you the man who knows too much? Is it that you are, your knowledge is so nuanced of the situation that they would prefer somebody who's not as nuanced in the situation?
Look, I would say there's many, many experts in the North beyond myself and many experts in the wider world. So in really, I'm guessing as to what the issue would be. And I think one of the things that we need to do in the next few weeks is maybe probe a bit further. So I'm hoping that, you know, somebody might ask the DUP directly. You know, I'm sitting here. I was interviewed for a position almost 18 months ago, and I don't know what the outcome is, you know. So in some senses, I'm responding to what is, you know, media speculation with my name out there. So I would really like and hope to see somebody ask the DUP directly, you know, is this the case or not? I would like clarification, but, you know, it's entirely consistent with what's been happening in the last 2 or 3 years. You know, the main unionist parties have all intervened with Queen's about me because of the work that I've been doing around this constitutional conversation.
And when you say intervene, Colin, people need to understand, there was calls for you to lose your job.
Well, there was questions around work that I was doing, a report that I published around the EU and Irish unity a number of years ago. And it's, I suppose now it's interesting to see that, you know, everybody is now moving into that space. So in some senses, yeah, you know, maybe there's a lesson there for sort of anybody thinking about making change. You know, sometimes you do have to be slightly disruptive in a sense to do that. But yeah, the unionist parties were very, very, members of unionists were very upset about a report I did a few years ago. I've had a lot of social media abuse. Many people have that. And there was even a sort of online concerned students group began to mobilize around myself and other people. So it was deeply unpleasant. But, you know, my view is, you know, I trust the integrity of what I've been doing. To me and to my mind and to many others, what I'm saying, what others are saying is perfectly reasonable, and particularly in the context of Brexit and what we need to be thinking about. So, but really, who I feel sorry for is that I'm in a very privileged position. I still have a job as of this evening. You know, we'll see. Queen's hasn't sacked me yet. But, you know, there are many people out here in this society who need those human rights that we're talking about, you know, most marginalized and vulnerable people in this city, in this region, who need those basic socioeconomic rights to be in place. And that's the people I feel sorry for. And, our system is standing in the way of that.
And within that, obviously, the bottleneck that Stormont has and how it hasn't served people since the Good Friday Agreement, that's totally fair. But within that, when you talk about the rights-based society, we also talk about it in the context of the shared Ireland. And, you know, we've seen recently where criticism has been levied at Sinn Féin's door for their abstention in a vote on reproductive choices and reproductive healthcare choices for people, and how that, you know, that flies in the face of what was campaigned for in the South in terms of repeal, and then the subsequent calls for the North is next. I'm assuming a lot of the reaction to the things that you're discussing is because some of these shared human rights, these socio-economic rights as well, boils down to social mobility, economic inequality, and the challenges we face across the island, be them and in health and housing, Colin. And there seems to be, again, a bad example of it this week, whereby a child is arrested, you know, for having their life possibly ruined for a criminal matter, when there are people that are said to be in the background instigating this, you know, because of certain belief patterns. And I know, Martin, you said it's the last sort of hanging on, but Colin, it does strike me that it can damage a lot of people if we don't look through everything through the prism of human rights. Going to pause the podcast because tomorrow evening, Wednesday the 10th of November, we are live in the Sugar Club. Tickets are still available on Eventbrite, but when I say limited, they are very limited. Put in today's podcast because it's the last shout. If you want to come along, there will be terrific guests lined up, and I know Rory is doing a panel on housing, and Caroline has an amazing show lined up for Glow West. we'll also be doing a echo chamber somewhere in there. So I'll reveal the guest before we go on stage. But yeah, really looking forward to it. As I said, a few tickets left. The link is in this podcast. If you click on the Eventbrite link, grab them before they're gone. And I hope to see lots of you tomorrow evening in a safe and fully seated gig. Bring your COVID certs. Thanks for the support.
No, I agree with that entirely, in the sense that human rights activism challenges everyone, and challenges every political party at times. You know, it isn't the property of any one political party or even the north of any one particular community. Being a human rights activist doesn't sometimes make you the most popular person in the room, right? Sometimes it isn't going to make you win an election to be standing up for the human rights of people. But I think it's absolutely fundamentally important. But, you know, we often focus here on division and conflict, but one of the striking things about some of these human rights issues is that, and we're seeing this across the island in areas like healthcare and housing, is that people want this stuff in legally guaranteed documents. They want enforceable rights in these areas. So rather than them being areas of conflict and division, they're actually areas of common ground. The blockage tends to be political, I think, in taking these forward. But, you know, politicians need to take a bit of comfort that some of the things we're talking about in this discussion, you know, are things that people would like to see guaranteed. And I think in many ways on the island, what's driving politics are those basic socioeconomic issues that people north and south want to see, you know, quite significant and radical change on.
Do you think the people of, and I mean both north and south, the majority of the people are ahead of the majority of the politicians?
There's absolutely no doubt, Martin, that that's true. Absolutely no doubt from the polling that I've seen. What the particular impediment in the north is the way that our institutions are put together. And to be candid, and I'll just name it, you know, in terms of this podcast, the way that the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, operate the institutions, you know, there's, you know, some of the mechanisms around veto are being used now for purposes they were never intended to be used for. And some of those blocking mechanisms are now essentially becoming a veto on human rights and equality in the north. You know, and you're watching in the last few years people having to go over the head of the Northern Executive and Assembly and go to Westminster to try and get some of those rights vindicated. So, you know, I think we have to be clear in just naming where the problem resides. But I suppose the harder question in the longer term is how we overcome that.
I think that's, I'm glad you've been so forthright about that, because it's important that we do name it. And we've seen in recent weeks the unionist parties go on an election footing. You know, they're talking about bringing down the executive, having an early election in early next year. They had a meeting between the three heads, and it seems that the decision seems to be that they will drag further to the right and solidify over there. Now, from a human rights basis, that's actually worse, because we're looking at, you know, things that in a progressive and liberal society are going to be more difficult to access. And we spoke to Sam McElwain, who I don't know if you've listened to Sam, but he's been on with us a few times. I'd term him as a lefty unionist, if anything. And yeah. Sam would be very much of the mindset that, you know, this nonsense of who cares about green and orange? We need to be actually making life better for people. And that's not going to happen, Colin, if they proceed down this path. But at the same time, they're not a majority. So they don't get to speak for everybody.
Yeah, and also bear in mind, political unionism doesn't necessarily speak for the unionist community here and its civic components. There are very many people across civic society here who see themselves as unionists and are unionists, who are fully supportive of some of the things that we're talking about. All the evidence that I've seen suggests that. We've even seen recent evidence around the protocol, for example, the suggestion that the unionist parties are over-egging the level of dissent within unionism around all of that. We've seen Doug Beattie and the UUP begin to try and take the UUP now in a different direction. And I think there's no doubt that some of the votes that the Alliance Party are attracting in the north are a direct consequence of, you know, unionists who are not comfortable, you know, not comfortable with Brexit, not comfortable with where the DUP has taken unionism, sort of looking around for other options. So, yeah, I don't believe the caricatures about unionism either. You know, there are unionists in the North who are very strong advocates of economic and social rights and social justice too.
Can I ask, sorry, Mark, can I ask one point on that? Because I think it's important that when all the work you've been doing over the last few years about the conversations that are happening on both sides and how we can move forward and a shared island and what that might look like, what we're talking about here. In all of those conversations, we've seen recently, again, talk about the protocol being, you know, it has to go. Yet trade is actually up. It's working the best of both worlds. And, you know, the economic benefits of it are being borne out. You know, there's some problems with the border, the metaphorical border down the Irish Sea. There are some problems there. But one of the big issues is the, like, and again, are people who say, I'm British and I will always be British. And are in that structured as you envisage it, there must be a space for that person in a shared island whereby the British identity can be maintained and protected.
Absolutely right. And just to two things there from what you said to me. First thing is in relation to the protocol. Let's be crystal clear. This is a, you know, Westminster government that's playing fast and loose with the North. You know, this deliberately nurturing instability for its own narrow purposes. These are very often Brexiteer ideologues who couldn't give a stuff, let's be candid, about people in Northern Ireland for all the sort of hot air that they produce around that. They don't care really about the North. And it's deeply, deeply disturbing. You know, the protocol there is to sort of mitigate some of the damage of Brexit, and it needs to be protected and it needs to be upheld. But the idea that they really care about the North, I think, is just wrong. They don't. They're pursuing their own narrow agenda. In terms of British identity in the future, absolutely. Like, Ireland's Future has just produced actually another document recently on rights and citizenship in a united Ireland. And people forget their guarantees there in the Good Friday Agreement that are rock solid, that are crystal clear already, that respect those rights into the future. So, you know, the Irish state, the new arrangements on the island will have to step up and make sure that, you know, British identity is protected, not just because I say so, but because it's a legal guarantee in the agreement. And even though this British government and previous British governments haven't been very good at upholding parity of esteem and mutual respect and all that, you know, on the island, the Irish state, those advocating change are better than that. You know, in a sense, we don't have to follow the poor record and the precedent of what successive British governments have done. We can do better. So I think the invitation is warm, welcome, and open to everyone who wants to engage. When people talk about a new and united Ireland, when Ireland's Future does that, you know, we're very, very serious as an organization that we want this to be better. You know, we don't just want this to be a sort of a, you know, second best. We want this to be the best possible outcome where people's rights are protected. And that includes British citizens in the North. You know, the view about constitutional changes, we'll be better off. And I think the evidence is clear that, you know, that is going to be the case across a range of areas.
There really is a golden opportunity to set a standard for the rest of the world. I mean, there is a golden opportunity in this.
Yep.
But also this next coming week, as you've mentioned, is going to be a very tense week.
Yeah.
Do you see forces using that tension to exploit the situation?
The return to what I said earlier, in a sense, you're absolutely right, Mark. You know, I'm deeply concerned at the way the current London government, which we could talk at length about in a number of respects, is really using the North as a pawn in what it sees as a tactical game with the European Union. And the risk is, you're right, that will destabilize the North, particularly what's going on within unionism and loyalism. But my hope would be that people will remain calm, that people will see what's happening ultimately for what it actually is, and keep a focus on stabilizing the arrangements we have here. It's been very noticeable to me that loyalism has not been able to mobilize the sorts of, you know, the very extreme anti-protocol protests, as we've seen, have really struggled to mobilize on any significant scale.
They haven't got the numbers that, they expected, Colin. And I know that sounds really like we're going, oh, well, they didn't get the numbers. That doesn't mean that it's not potentially dangerous. It's not potentially a threat to security and those issues. But when you think about it, this kicked off at around Easter of this year, and there were attempts to stoke tensions. Yeah. And there were some scenes, but it didn't escalate. It didn't escalate. It actually dissipated. And I think that's actually encouraging. But you're quite right, both of you, to point out that the British government in Westminster don't give a shit. This is a game to them.
You said that.
Oh, absolutely. But I think it's very clear that they don't. That it's purely that it's purely a decision. I mean, we have Boris Johnson, who now, it's been said by different European leaders, you cannot make a deal with him because he will go back on them. I mean, that's not something you want said about the leader of a country, and, you know, let alone within trade deals, within all of these talks. So no, it's a bad situation whereby this protocol is going to be used, and it is being used as a political tool. And whether they invoke the article and whether they go that route, I do think though to counterbalance that, I want to be positive and say, for example, conversations that are happening about the shared future. You were at one yesterday in Dublin, and there was an important point that I made it on the podcast earlier that Mary Lou MacDonald, the leader of Sinn Féin, said that the health service is going to be more important than flags. I mean, this is much more. This is where the conversation is, even if there are people still wanting to talk about flags and national anthems. And you know, everybody knows that the Divine Comedy's at the Indie Disco is going to be the national anthem in the Shared Island. So we've parked that.
Okay, that's sorted. That now. Yeah, exactly. We've resolved that.
Exactly. You know, so we just, my point being, it doesn't really matter where we go with that. No. What we care about is housing, healthcare, opportunities for our children, social mobility, you know, education. Educational attainment, all of those things. And they're the conversations that you're engaged with and the organization are engaged with.
No, excellent event in Dublin yesterday, Ireland's Future, really thoughtful event. Good to see sort of a range of political parties as well engaging in the conversation. I was really struck, for example, with Neil Richmond and how forceful he was about this being the right time to have this conversation. So I think it was good to see that. But you're right, you know, back to the earlier point about the Bill of Rights, actually, that, you know, socioeconomic issues are driving politics on the island at the moment. When you ask people, it's remarkable, health actually comes out top of their list in terms of their anxieties about constitutional change. So I think if you're advocating, you know, a united Ireland, ultimately, then you're going to have to say something meaningful about the health service, because that's the sort of thing that's going to motivate people when they could go to vote. I do think, however, going back to the agreement also gives assurances about issues of culture and identity that will be of concern to people within the unionist community here. And those need to be fleshed out. But you're right. I suspect that those sorts of basic socioeconomic issues are what people are going to be thinking about. And the other thing that struck me yesterday was there's just so much rubbish spoken about the South and the North, and there's so much rubbish spoken about the North and the South. You know, we don't actually, you know, once you drill into the actual evidence, what actually happens in the health service in the North, what actually happens in the health service in the South, and other things as well, you know, we'll enlighten each other by having this discussion, you know, because there's just a lot of mythology around at the moment.
There is, actually, and it must be frustrating for people like yourself, though. I put it to you that you know, whenever we see across on the floor to Dáil, whenever anything is mentioned, particularly, and again, this sounds like I'm giving Sinn Féin a boost. I'm not. I'm simply pointing out that if I was a citizen who identified as Irish currently and living in the north of the island, quite often it's but in the north, it's, and we need to move past that as well in our politics and in our reporting. It's deeply unhelpful to that what a shared future might look like. And
I find it, just to come straight back there, I find it really, really insulting. You know, I'm an Irish citizen, you know, in the north, as Irish as anybody else on this island, and I'm absolutely fed up at the way we are treated. You know, in terms of, you know, even voting rights, the issue around presidential elections, that really modest reform, you know, we've struggled to make any advances there. So I'm an Irish citizen. I'm a European Union citizen as well. and I want to be treated with equality and respect on the island that I live in. I was born in Derry and live in Belfast, and I'm Irish, you know. Get used to it, you know. And I think, you know, in a post-Brexit context, you know, when we have an opportunity that Irish reunification also involves returning to the European Union, as an EU citizen, as an Irish citizen, I want to talk about that. I want to work for it because I've got a right to do that in the Good Friday Agreement. And I don't feel I should be not appointed to particular positions because I happen to think that and say that out loud. And I'm just delighted that more and more people now are having the courage to join that conversation as well. But yeah, I'm fed up with listening to that too. And I think we need to make more progress in the here and now as well.
We've heard that reflected from the people we know from living up north. We've heard it from Emma D'Souza.
Yep.
We've heard it from others as well, that there's a whole section of the middle who don't want this argument. They simply don't want it. They're quite prepared to move forward in some way to something other than what we are, what we have at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Mark, particularly about the argument about constitutional change. Because I find myself often up here and on the island, people will label me, they'll say, you're a nationalist, right? They'll use that language of nationalism. And what I find, I understand where that comes from. And that's, you know, the argument and the box that many of the things that I say fit into. But I've worked all my life in the area of human rights, the human rights of everyone on the island. And the idea, I don't see myself in narrow nationalistic terms in any way at all. You know, I see this as an argument about creating a pluralist Ireland where human rights of everyone are respected. But up here, you have to, people have to put you in a stereotypical box, you know, and caricature you. And I do find the language of, you know, oh, you're a nationalist, you know, because when you go elsewhere in Europe and people start describing you, you know, they sometimes see that in a very particular way. Mm-hmm. I find that language problematic, you know. And it's just people need to get used to the debate is becoming more complicated, complex, and people up here are complicated and complex, just like people in the South, you know.
Well, the people in the South, they tend, if I can push in, Martin, tend to have this kind of, yeah, no, we'd rather fit you into a pigeonhole if that's okay. It'd be much more convenient if we can just say that's an, and sure, you know, there is like, I mean, I know we see the jokes, but I don't know if you remember Tadhg Hickey's video where he went, I'm sure they're just angry anyway. You know, they're just angry. You know, it's like, but the truth is we've a lot to answer and deal with in terms of our own history, and it particularly around 100 years after partition. And the conversations that are only happening now, particularly, there's been a dishonesty at the core of it, Martin, would you agree, in terms of what we, because you spoke about it yourself on News Talk recently when you were asked about partition, and I thought you explained it very well about the sectarian nature of it. And it's just those conversations in the South, are even people are uncomfortable having them, because then we have to acknowledge, you know, our own role in that.
Yeah. Maybe just, you know, my own view is, and I know it's a very, very old argument, and others have talked about what would happen if you divided the island in this way, but it has played out, you know, the old Connolly thing about carnival reaction and all of that. You know, we're only ever going to get to, I think, sort of real politics on the island, real socioeconomic political alignments when the border goes, to be candid. I think, you know, partition is divisive in itself. And I think we're only going to get to a proper kind of politics on the island. It seems self-evidently true. You know, a united Ireland is exactly that. It's not a divided Ireland. And I think we're only going to get the sort of arrangements in place that I think many people would like to see on the far side of this. And I think at the moment, that's like, I don't like the language of inevitability, because I think nothing is ever inevitable. There's histories, the history of movements that have said things are inevitable. And then, you know, what was the old Marx thing? You know, the state would wither away. You know, well, funnily enough, the state...
We're always just on the cusp of capitalism failing, Colin.
So I think nothing inevitable, but I think that we're entering a period in which this is where things are heading. And I think we need to prepare properly for it, talk it through. But, you know, for me... myself, I'm involved in this because, you know, people throw about, you know, political cliches, you know, a new Ireland, you know, I'm in it because I believe in the new bit of it, you know, I believe in the better bit of it. I think partition and division have been a disaster for us in the North. Like, I think it's holding back the island, and I think we would be better as a result of having this discussion. So I think, you know, you used to use the language of opportunity. You know, it's a great opportunity. And you can see that in younger generation, even yesterday, of people like, this is a, what a chance, you know, to think about redesigning or having a go at new arrangements on the island, and not repeat the mistakes that we've made in the last 100 years. It won't be utopia, and it'll always be a work in progress. You know, those struggling for human rights and equality won't have to sort of down tools the day after reunification. There'll still be that struggle to try and achieve those rights and equality goals, but I think we'll be better off as a result.
I think the fears that gave rise to partition became self-fulfilling prophecies, and that we have to unpick that, and that as an island, we would have been far, far better off without it. That said, I think you could be more accurately described as a there is better than this is, rather than a nationalist. And I think that works for both sides.
Yeah. And I understand why, you know, and there's different versions of that. There's new and narrow and all that. But I think the conversation that we're in at the moment is a conversation that sounds different from some of the, you know, the language that's been used around this in the past. And there's new voices, particularly post-Brexit, entering that debate as well. And I think that's important. And ultimately, if people are going to win a referendum in the North around this, that's going to have to happen. You know, I don't think using the same old arguments that have failed for 100 years are going to persuade people in a referendum in the North. I think a new approach is required.
Well, whatever about Marxism and whatever about nationalism, we sound like three Gramsci people here saying that it's time to stop. You know, what's the old saying?
If you keep hegemonic. Battle of ideas.
Pessimism but optimism of the will. And there's certainly optimism of the will now, you know.
We have to always get that the right way around, I think, in terms of when you say that. But I think, you know, there is something in that about discussions over narratives and framing the narratives around that. I think there is a bit of a battle on the island at the moment about the narrative framing of all this. I think what's been striking the last few years, I even thought about it yesterday as I was listening, you know, that sometimes you start off as a marginal lone voice, and then suddenly you go to events and you find other people saying similar things, you know, or using similar language. And I think it's been interesting to watch with Ireland's future over the recent years, that things that maybe even 3 or 4 years ago felt like very, very outlier points of view, that felt like marginal points to make, suddenly becoming more and more mainstream, you know, and I think that's encouraging.
We can definitely empathize with that. Where we were 4 years ago, everybody is today. So, no, we can definitely empathize with that.
This Colin is the Harvey, podcast to be on today.
It is, absolutely. Absolutely, every time. Colin Harvey, thanks very much for having this conversation with us. And we do wish you your best in your career. We
thank you so much.
Much appreciate your income.
Very much appreciate
income as well.
No payment has changed hands here, people. I can confirm.
I can tell you there's been no payments made.
I'm just delighted to be invited back. You know, you're now all toxic as a result of having me on your podcast.
We had a conversation the other evening with Konstantin Gordiev, and it was 600 episodes since we'd had him on previously. And Martin made the mistake of referring to him as one of our favorite guests, and he went, "Oh yeah, after 600 episodes." Okay.
I'll be counting, you know, now.
Yeah. And I'm a pessimist because of intelligence, but an optimist because of will. I think. We'll stick with Gramsci and hope there's better times ahead.
Absolutely.
Harvey, thanks for talking to us again. Reminder, folks, we are live in the Sugar Club on Wednesday. There's a handful of tickets left. So if the link is on the bottom of the pod and you want to come, get them now, because I don't want to be you guys chasing me saying, are there any tickets left? There won't be. They're not. It's limited. It's still, even though it's not COVID times, we are kind of on a restricted access here. So please grab them before there's any hassle. Talk to you all very, very soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin. Martin and Tony. Speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. subscribe now on Patreon.